This episode, Once Upon a What If. Hello, and welcome to the Once Upon a Geek podcast, a proud member of the Fire and Water Podcast Network. On today's episode, we are once again finding our joy by talking about that fantastic Marvel comic series that explores the multiverse of cause and effect, a comic series entitled What If? Now, my name is the Irredeemable Shag, and I'm your host, but I am not doing this alone, thankfully. For this installment of What If, I am joined by a fellow founder of the Fire and Water Podcast Network, and a man who can answer the question, what if someone bought too many action figures and toys? Folks, please help me welcome to the show, Mr. Chris Franklin. How you doing, buddy? Thanks for being here.
I'm doing fine, Shag, but I am literally under an avalanche of toys I got for Christmas and then went and bought more of after Christmas. So it's like, what am I doing with my life? But I enjoy the hell out of it. So
clearly not learning your lesson, that's for sure.
No, learning nothing.
I do the same thing every time I go to a used bookstore. I come home with more books and I have no bookshelves for them anymore. And I'm starting to have to box up books and put them in the garage, which breaks my heart. And it's a sickness, Chris. We have sicknesses.
Yes, we do. I think we're called hoarders.
No, don't use those words. My wife might be listening. Well, folks, we are excited to talk about What If. It's a fantastic comic series. There's two volumes. We've done an episode previously. If you go back to a year ago, January 2023, I sat down with JT the Exterminator to do some What If comics. In fact, if you liked JT's appearance, he's on the JLI podcast this month as well. But Chris and I thought it'd be fun, especially with the new What If series out there, it'd be a great time to talk about it. Now, Chris, I am wondering, you know, what is your history with What If?
You know, sadly, I rarely found the original series on the newsstand. I don't think my regular comic book haunt, Eastside Pharmacy, ever carried the original series. I would see it occasionally at the local Begley Drug, where, oddly enough, Cindy's mom worked, but I didn't know Cindy yet. I knew her mom, but I didn't know her. And I picked up my only two issues of What If, Volume 1 there, this one that we're going to talk about today, and about a year prior, the All Humor issue. And then I did get the Volume 2 at the newsstand. So I bought quite a few of those.
I just figured you picked up a copy of What If I Marry Your Daughter from that drugstore. But anyway.
Yeah, that's right.
So the humor issue, number 34. I think everyone, like every time I mention Who's Who, everybody remembers the humor issue, issue 34. That's so funny.
Yeah, I mean, there's images from that book that live rent-free in my brain, you know, for the past 40 years. Like Cyclops shooting his blast out of his ears. Hulk is Ricky Ricardo and She-Hulk is Lucy, which is kind of weird considering their cousins. Right. And then Black Widow eating Spider-Man's bones with his empty costume. Yeah. So.
Oh my gosh. See, it's funny. For me, Volume 2, Issue 34, was also a humor issue. Like they followed the standard of the first series. So I actually read Volume 2's 34 before I ever read the other one. And then I went on to become a diehard fan of What The, which, you know, is very much in that same spirit. I adore it.
Yes. Yes. And I bought a lot of What The. I could find it on the newsstand. So yeah, I love that. Yeah.
So what attracts you to the whole concept of What If?
I'm a big fan of parallel worlds, although even I'm getting a bit sick of all the multiversal stuff in every kind of media these days. But I still love to think about how characters and stories could have developed with major or minor changes. It's why I'm Earth 2 Chris. You know, Earth 2 was my first parallel world I encountered in, yes, Marv Wolfman. I got it at age 3, so it's okay. I think we all ponder how our life could have been different with different decisions. So it's just a perfect storytelling device.
But the part where you said you're getting sick of multiversal stories, which I totally agree with, is exactly why I can hear you agreeing with me that crisis had to happen. So thank you, Chris. I'm glad we have settled.
Here we go again.
For those of you who don't know, Chris and I fought about this on, I think it was Supermates, maybe. I don't know.
Yeah.
It was like, you know, gosh, 10 years ago now or something.
Yeah,
I don't
it was
know.
Way long time ago. Yeah.
Oh my gosh. So, all right. Volume 1, Volume 2, you know, the subsequent individual issues. Where do you fall? Where is it at for you?
I had more of Volume 2, but I've since read a lot of Volume 1. And I have to say, I think the first volume was a bit more polished. Hmm. Volume 2 had its good points and a lot of great issues, but it was a bit 90s.
You think?
Especially as it went... As we will see, you know.
Yeah. Just a little 90s, just a bit. Now, all right, no spoilers for anyone, but you know, the What If season 2 is out. Go watch it on Disney Plus. And no spoilers for me specifically, because I've only watched the first two episodes, because I'm I'm restricting myself. I'll only let me watch it when I get on the treadmill. It's like an incentive to get out there and get on the treadmill, which clearly I've only done once in this new year. But the first two episodes were amazing. So I think, if I remember, you've been watching the animated series, right?
Right. We've watched the whole series at this point. I won't get spoilery, but it was really great. I liked it even better than the first season. Mm. Cindy is a huge fan of Peggy Carter, and I don't think I'm spoiling much by saying Captain Carter is pretty important in this season. So that was big in the Franklin household. And I just want to say, if you're watching What If while working on a treadmill, you might end up on Earth too. I'm just saying. I don't know.
No. Didn't even think about that. Oh my God, it was right there in front of me. Oh my gosh. That's what I'm going to tell my wife from now on. I'm going to say, honey, I'm going to get on the cosmic treadmill. And she's just going to say, shut up. So that's probably, you've met her. You know how she is. Yeah. Yours punches people. Mine just doesn't give a crap about what the stuff we're interested in. So now, before we get too much further, we do need to take a second to thank our sponsors. Folks, this episode of Once Upon a Geek is sponsored in part by InStockTrades.com. InStockTrades is your best online source for comic book trades, hardcovers, and other collected editions, all for up to 42% off with free shipping on orders of $50 or more. In each episode, we select a comic book collected edition to discuss briefly from their library, and it's usually tied in the discussion in some way, shape, or form. I was lazy. And I just picked a really obvious one. I picked What If? Classic Trade Paperback Collection, Volume 1. So this is a great trade. It collects the first 12 issues of the original Who's Who. The original What If. So you've got Spider-Man joining the FF, Hulk with Banner's brain, you know, all the stuff that you know. Everyone's seen those early issues, or you've probably read on Marvel Unlimited or whatever, but they're all fantastic. And I agree with you. I think Volume 1 is probably more polished. Doesn't necessarily mean that's where my heart belongs, but I agree that, you know, subjectively, it's better. So Volume 1, first 12 issues, full color, soft cover, normally goes for $39.99, but you can get it for 38% off, so it's only $24.79. And that is a bargain. What's that, $2 an issue? That's a heck of a deal for some fantastic, you know, remastered, awesome-looking What Ifs. Now, buddy, what'd you bring?
I brought the Amazing Spider-Man Epic Collection Great Power. This is actually collects the very first Spider-Man stories from Steve Ditko, Stan Lee, and, you know, Jack Kirby sprinkled in here and there. Everybody knows this is it began in Amazing Fantasy number 15. This is, you know, the origin of Spider-Man. This is when he first encountered all his major villains. It collects Amazing Spider-Man 1 through 17, Amazing Spider-Man Annual number 1, which is the Sinister Six, which is awesome, and material from Amazing Fantasy number 15, of course. So this, if you have to own one Spider-Man book, you should own this one.
Not the Clone Saga?
No, not the Clone Saga. No. Everything is based on this, so just buy this one. It was $44.99. In-stock price trade is now $27.98. You save 38%. That's a steal. These are some of the greatest comics ever made.
And I got to say, those Epic collections are gorgeous. I bought a couple Epic collections myself, and they are just... Marvel took the trade paperback existing format and took it up a notch when they started doing these Epic collections. They're really, really well put together. Mm-hmm. I haven't seen this particular one, so I can't speak what's in there, but a lot of times there's extra material in there. There's linkage stuff in there. It's always really impressive. So great pick. Awesome. And it might be a little bit of hint what Chris is going to pick for What If today, folks.
Mm-hmm.
So for this and all your other comic book trade paperback needs, please visit InStockTrades.com. Now, this episode is also sponsored in part with your Patreon support. You know, running the Firewater Podcast Network with so many shows, you know, requires a whole lot of online hosting and other services. And a while back, we realized we needed some help with the expenses. So we launched the Patreon, and you folks really stepped up to help keep the network going. So if you're enjoying shows on the network, the best way to support the shows is by visiting our Patreon, which is patreon.com/FW podcast. And while you're there, please consider supporting the network, and at certain tiers, you'll get mentioned on your favorite shows. This episode's special thanks go out to Michael Salk, David Ace Gutierrez, and Gord Tolton. Again, please visit our Patreon at patreon.com/FW podcast. Now, folks, we talked a little bit about this on the previous on the previous What If episode. We want to hear your thoughts. We want to know what are your favorite issues of What If. We want to know recommendations, because I haven't read them all. I want to know which ones I need to read. So get on the socials and help us out. The best way to be part of the conversation is by visiting the comments section on our website, which is fireandwaterpodcast.com/onceuponageek. Of course, you can find us on Twitter and Blue Sky as Once Upon a Geek, or on Facebook and Instagram as Once Upon a Geek Podcast. If you share your thoughts on our website in the comments section, I will be reading portions of that feedback on every fifth episode of Once Upon a Geek. This happens to be the 17th episode, so you still got time to get it in. I'll be covering your feedback on the 20th, so please share your thoughts on these particular issues, your favorite issues of What If, all that. We want to hear about it. Now, what we're going to do is we're going to take a quick podcast promo break, and then when we come back, we are going to dive into two issues of the classic What If.
Just imagine the mightiest heroes of our time.
All of them on one team.
Since there are so many of us, we have a chance to do more than just put out fires. We can be proactive. We can do some real good in the world.
JLU Cast brings you coverage of Justice League Unlimited, the ultimate gathering of DC's heroes and villains, and the culmination of the greatest interpretation of the DC Universe ever.
Join Chris and Cindy Franklin as they relive the team-ups, the battles, the conspiracies.
I had no idea that the Girl Scouts were responsible for the crop circle phenomenon.
Few people do. Few even think to ask the question.
The romance and the fun.
A head start. You're getting soft in your old age.
Don't you have a tall building to go leave?
And the adventure continues.
Find us wherever fine Fire and Water podcasts are available.
Where am I?
In the Palace of Glittering Delights.
Who are you?
I am Andrew Leyland, and for over 200 episodes, I have covered everything genre-related, from the obvious things that everyone talks about, Star Trek, to deep dives into the early issues of The Amazing Spider-Man via the obscure, such as ITC's experimental science fiction dramas The Champions or Department S.
It's very cosmopolitan. You never know who you meet next.
In the Palace of Glittering Delights.
Okay, let's get this show on the road, gang.
Available from Two True Freaks and via your podcatcher of choice.
All right, it is time to dive into What If, Volume 1, Issue number 46. Chris, this was your pick. Why don't you tell us about it?
This is What If Spider-Man's Uncle Ben Had Lived. It was, of course, published by Marvel Comics. Cover date was August 1984. And according to Mike's Amazing World, RIP Mike, thank you for all the wonderful website, which we will continue to use for decades to come. It was released on May 15th, 1984. The cover price was $1, so it was higher than most comic books back then, believe it or not. Page count was 39 pages. And the cover was by Ron Frenz. And I believe it may have also been inked by Bill Sienkiewicz. There's a little scrawly signature.
That's absolutely his signature. Yeah, that's Bill Sienkiewicz, without a doubt. And you can, once you know that, you can see it in the scratchiness. It's like, oh yeah, that is.
Yeah, that is. Yeah, so on this cover, Peter Parker is trapped in his own web, half of his body in his Spider-Man costume, his spider sense tingling as large floating heads of Uncle Ben Parker and J. Jonah Jameson argue over his fate. Over the blue background are more floating heads of Aunt May, Betty Brant, Liz Allen, Vulture, Sandman, Green Goblin, Dr. Octopus, and John Jameson, and a few random folks, which I don't know why they're random folks there, but hey, you know, okay, you know. So what do you think of this one, Jack?
Oh, I think it's great. I think it's absolutely stunning. Now, stealing one of your notes you're about to say, is that it absolutely channels Ditko. I mean, it without a doubt, and that is, that's got to be a hard skill to do, right? I mean, it really looks great. Now, here's where I get a little negative about it, and not even negative, it's just critical, because that's what you do on a podcast, right? I'm not sure it sells the premise of the what-if concept in this one. I mean, Uncle Ben's there, sure, and he's arguing with J. Jonah, but it feels more like, I don't know, like a Spider-Man poster or something, like, you know, stock image rather than what if Ben lived. But I'm not sure what you would show. You know, I don't know, Ben standing over May's dead body. I don't know what you would get. But I love it. I just don't know if it sells the what if concept.
Yeah, I could see maybe Peter and Ben at May's grave with the symbolic Spider-Man looming over top of them or something. You know, that might have worked. But I guess that would be a little similar to one of the splash pages that we're going to get. But, you know, honestly, though, as we get into the story, you know, Ben and Jonah arguing over Spider-Man is actually going to play in. So it does fit the story. But as far as selling the concept, you might be right.
What about you? Do you love the cover? Is it satisfactory? What do you think?
I think it does. I think it, again, gets to the heart of what the story is about, the direction that the story goes into. And I always am a sucker for the half Peter, half Spidey image. And he's trapped in his own web. And, you know, there's a lot of great Spider-Man covers with floaty heads. And floaty heads are always good. So, yeah, it's... I think it's great. And he's definitely, Ron Frenz is totally, like, I don't know if he had a seance. I know Ditko wasn't deceased, but did he, like, channel him in this issue? We'll get into that. But, yeah, there's a lot of Ditko in this issue for sure.
Well, I love how the white webbing is, like, it's like pulling Peter in two different directions. Like, he's being pulled apart. And now that I think about it, now you're the art guy, not me here, but wouldn't that white have to been done with, like, a color hold or something?
Yeah, it's a color hold. It's a surprint, you know, as Rob would say. It's definitely is. Yeah, and I like the fact that it's a white web versus a black one, and it makes it feel more like a real spider web. It's not symmetrical, so I mean, it's a really nice image, and I like the blue is lighter behind his body, so there's a gradient, you know, color. It all pulls you, the figureheads pull you in toward the central figure of Peter/Spider-Man as well.
Yeah, it's a good point. Layout's fantastic. Yeah. All right, let's get into it.
All righty. So this story was written by Peter B. Gillis. The penciler was Ron Frenz. The finisher was Sam Della Rosa. The letterer was John Morelli. Colorist Bob Sharon. Editor Ralph Macchio. No, not that one. Editor-in-chief Jim Shooter. And it was approved by Danny Fingeroth, who I guess was at the time, I believe, the Spider-Man editor. So,
okay.
Peter Parker visits the grave of the loved one he let down due to his irresponsible action. He walks away from the gravesite to be comforted by his Uncle Ben, not the rice guy either. Yes, in this reality, as Uatu the Watcher informs us, May Parker confronted the burglar in the Parker household and was shot and killed. When Peter returns home late and learns his aunt has been murdered, Ben is surprised at Peter's reaction. Weeks later, Ben observes former TV star Spider-Man, the man who apprehended May's killer, swinging into their home. He eventually reveals that he knows Peter's secret. Hiding his Spider-Man costume under a tablecloth, he asks Peter to change. Peter explains how he feels responsible for May's death, having selfishly refused to stop the man who eventually killed her. But Ben bears his own guilt, sleeping through May's murder. Having aired their feelings, they both resolve to move forward, with Ben supporting Peter's career as Spider-Man. Over the next several months, Spider-Man foils the plans of costume criminals like the Sandman, Green Goblin, and Electro. But instead of being praised for his heroism, he is constantly dogged by Daily Bugle publisher and editor J. Jonah Jameson, using photos Peter takes of himself as Spider-Man to illustrate his libel tirades. Furious that Jameson is not only besmirching his nephew's name, but also insulting May's memory, he confronts the newspaper man in his office. Peter tries to intervene as Spider-Man, but Ben's mind is set. He wants to prove to Jameson that Spider-Man is no mere publicity-seeking glory hound, but a responsible hero with good intention. So he has Peter unmasked before a gobsmacked Jameson, telling him it's up to him to use that information how he sees fit. Jameson ponders exposing Peter to Spider-Man, but comes up with a much better plan. Extortion. When Spider-Man makes a bust, the Bugle reporters are there. Jameson continues to hound Spider-Man, but allows him to tell his side, essentially making Spider-Man a staff member of the Bugle. But when Jameson asks Peter to tell his suspicious acting secretary, Betty Brant, Peter refuses. He is shocked to learn Ben agrees with Jameson, despite knowing how Peter feels about Betty. Infuriated that two old men are bossing him around, Peter decides to prove them wrong. But when he tells Betty, he finds that she is tied up with organized crime, and Spider-Man's old foe, Dr. Octopus, via her shady brother, Bennett. Spidey is so despondent over this, he wallows in self-pity and starts shirking his duties as both Peter and Spider-Man. Jameson sends a messenger to find Spider-Man and tell him that if he doesn't get back on the job, he'll expose his secret identity. So Peter shows up to a press conference where Jameson is glad-handing his own son, astronaut John Jameson, who is ill from exposure to mysterious space spores. Things go sideways when the Green Goblin, certain that Jameson knows Spider-Man's true identity, abducts the publisher and flies off. His son enraged, the space spores mutate him into a powerful giant who stomps across the city hoping to save his father. Peter could care less about any of this, but then realizes he's right back to square one and he must use his power responsibly. Spider-Man shows up to rescue JJJ, but not before John takes out the Green Goblin and then succumbs to madness trying to hurt his own father. Spider-Man defeats him, knocking him into an electrical panel that magically cures his space illness. Back at the Parker home, Peter and Ben read the headlines, which make John the hero. But both can live with that, understanding Jonah is just as human as they are. But they'll get through it all together.
Oof, man, that is a wild ride of an issue.
Yeah, it is.
So obviously you got this when you were young. So, like, what are your thoughts on this one?
Well, this comic came out at a perfect time for me because since late 1981, Marvel Tales had been running the original Lee Ditko run of Amazing Spider-Man in chronological chronological order.
Mm-hmm.
So the events of this comic, or the original versions of them anyway, were very well known to me because I bought every issue of Marvel Tales and I loved it. I had no trouble finding Marvel Tales.
So, right. It was everywhere. That's true.
Despite some great stories and Amazing Spider-Man and Spectacular Spider-Man by the likes of Roger Stern and Bill Mantlo, I actually preferred the Lee Ditko stuff at the time. So this was great.
Interesting for me. See, I struggled because this is my first time reading this thing. And like, I don't know the classic stories. So like, I felt a little adrift, you know, especially like when you get deep into that Betty Brant story with her brother. And then later when you get into that story with J. Jonah's son, like I could tell that this was probably from a previous comic. And I could almost feel that I was missing stuff. I'm like, okay, I'm following what's happening and I feel like we're here because it's important, but I don't really get why. But clearly that wasn't an issue for you, right?
Right. And I think that's probably something that's a shortcoming of What If, because they try to pack so much into each issue that they don't bother giving you the backstory. They assume you know it, or, well, you'll figure it out as you go along, you know?
Right. So. Yeah, and I don't want to upset it. Like, I could follow it. Like, I could follow what was happening. I just knew, I could tell I was missing stuff. That's all.
Yeah, yeah. But it is kind of like, it works kind of like a weird director's cut of that run of comics that I was already reading. So it, you know, it really works out that way. So
yeah, no, that makes sense. And I felt that way whenever I read a What If where I do know the story. So I totally get it. Yeah.
Yeah.
So you were talking about he's channeling Ditko. I mean, I totally see that. I also feel like I see a little Michael Golden in here, but maybe that's Michael Golden channeling Ditko. I don't know, but I don't know. So you're seeing a lot of Ditko and Friends' work, right?
Right. Yeah. I mean, he's specifically lifting like panels and just not so much like he's not redrawing exactly panels, but like figures are very Ditko based, and you know, the layout of the pages is very much like Ditko. He has definitely got that on his mind. And it's, you know, Ron Frenz is a great artist on his own, but he's also a great mimic because he did a really good Kirby when he took over Thor after he left Spider-Man.
Okay.
So yeah, he's really good at that. And it's kind of funny because I thought, in my mind had told me that, well, this was Ron Frenz's first Spider-Man gig. No, he'd been drawing Amazing Spider-Man for quite some time before this. And in fact, he drew the famous The Kid Who Collected Spider-Man story that everyone remembers. And it also in a very Ditko-esque style. You know, his style for Spider-Man was always kind of Ditko, but that one was more so. So he'd been doing it for a while. So he was the regular Amazing Spider-Man artist. So that was another reason this seemed more legit, you know.
Okay. The guy, he doesn't get enough credit as like being regarded, you know, he's not a name that comes up a lot, you know, when you're talking about famous comic artists, but he did this work. He's done a ton of Marvel work over the years. Like he did the whole, well, not whole, but he did a huge chunk of the Spider-Girl stuff too. I mean, yeah. He built a whole other spider empire over there just with her. So, I mean, the guy's done so much to help the foundation of the comics we love. It's interesting.
Yeah. I've always been a fan of his. And I mean, he had a pretty solid run on the Superman comics and the Triangle era, you know, and so yeah, I mean he's got a great body of work, and I think he's a super solid artist. He gets that classic superhero style, you know.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot more talking heads and people in civilian clothes in this issue, really, than superheroes, and he pulls it off very well.
That's a good point. Yeah, absolutely.
So this story essentially takes us through Amazing Fantasy number 15, from there through Amazing Spider-Man number 42. So that was shortly after John Romita took over the art chores. There's a little bit of John Romita in here. And in fact, Marvel Tales was just up to Amazing Spider-Man number 28. So some of the stuff at the end, I was a little lost too with the whole John Jameson thing. I'm like, wait a minute, John Jameson's the Man Wolf. What, when did this happen? You know, so he was a giant.
Did he turn into a giant like that at some point, I guess?
Yes, he does in Amazing Spider-Man number 42. Yes. He's actually wearing a kind of space containment suit that later is what his ripped up Man Wolf suit is. So,
interesting. Okay.
Yeah. So, I love the device that Gillis uses on the first few pages. I love how he starts this out, because we knew Ben was alive from the cover, but we didn't necessarily know that Aunt May was dead because her face is on the cover, her floating head's on the cover. So, so, you know, to show them, like, you know, Peter's at the grave and he walks away and, you know, Friends does the nice Spider-Man, you know, the spider symbol silhouette in the background. And then he turns around, and there's Ben, you know, with the umbrella. It's like, whoa, you know, that was kind of a shocker.
So, like, I felt the same way. Like, I thought he was at Ben's grave. And then we were going to get a Watu going, you know, this is what happened in your reality. But what if it had changed? You know, like, that's what I was expecting, was it was Ben. So total misdirection was great. And then another thing I noticed in the reread was he used black panel borders instead of white panel borders on those pages of the grave, which is subtle, but it's so effective. It's so somber that I didn't even pick up on it the first time, but I did the second time because I'm, you know, thinking about it more from a podcasty sort of perspective. Really neat effect.
Yeah, and in fact, I, as many times I've read this story, that's the first time I ever noticed it. So good call. Good catch.
Podcasts make you look too closely at things.
Yeah, sometimes they do, and sometimes that's not a great thing. But yeah, this time, that's a nice bit. Yeah, I like that. You know, another thing that this, I don't know if it was ever established before, but here we find out that, you know, Uncle Ben got out of bed in our world, in the 616 universe, because he had back pain. So he was already alert when he heard the burglar downstairs. So that's what happened. And in the what if reality, he didn't have back pain. So Aunt May gets up because he's sleeping so soundly. So I thought that was kind of an interesting angle for, you know, for one of a nail type thing, you know, for one of a back pill that, you know, Uncle Ben's like.
So I didn't realize that was the first time this was introduced. So is that a reoccurring thing that Ben had back pain and they, or do we not know? I don't really know enough about my Spider-Man lore.
I don't really know. I don't know what's been established where, you know, I know there's some things that, you know, I know they flesh things out, you know. Well, for one, Ben doesn't say in the original story, with great power comes great responsibility. That's Stan Lee as the narrator that says that in the last panel of Amazing Fantasy 15. But, and I think they may have attributed that to Ben in flashbacks later, but Cliff Robertson, you know, cemented that's what Uncle Ben says until that's what Aunt May says in Spider-Man No Way Home. So spoiler warning. But
I totally didn't see that coming either. And the minute it happened, I'm like, oh, I'm such an idiot.
Oh, yeah, I know. It's like, oh, man. And this is probably, you know, oddly enough, this is the first time Aunt May dies, you know. So yeah. And speaking of May, she's only in a few panels, but Friends follows Ditko and especially Romita and making her look like a desiccated corpse even when she's alive. So that... I think it's even harder to swallow now because, you know, when you have Marissa Tomei play Aunt May and then you go back to Crypt Keeper Aunt May, you're like, whoa, you know?
Yeah, yes.
Yeah, you know, despite that, the panels where Ben finds May's lifeless body, that they're very powerful. And I love how Friends zooms out of the scene with no backgrounds. It makes us feel how small and vulnerable and totally alone Ben is. It's just really well done.
And 9-panel grid, too, by the way. Yep. So Keith Giffen would have been proud.
Yep. And Steve Ditko was a big 9-panel grid guy, too.
Oh,
so.
I didn't know that. Okay. Very cool.
Yeah, he was.
I don't know my Spider-Man lore well enough.
Yeah, you need to get that trade paperback we were talking about.
So, well, you know. I've read hundreds of Spider-Man comics, but all more like 80s, 90s, 2000s.
Yeah, I got you. Yeah, I'm serious. I mean, if anybody here hasn't read the original Lee Ditko run, it really is that good. It really is. It lives up to the hype. It's like the Lee Kirby Fantastic Four and the Lee Ditko Spider-Man. Those are if you got to read two Marvel runs, read those. I mean, the Thor run's good too, but pound for pound, those two are the best in my opinion. But that's
all right. I got to get that done then.
I got to say, and I don't know how you thought about this, but one of my favorite parts is that Ben gives Flash Thompson hell.
Yeah, that's great.
I mean, the guy stops by Peter's house with Liz and some of their friends, and I guess they were coming by to check on Peter, which is, you know, ostensibly sweet. You know, his aunt died, they're checking on him. But he walks in and insults the kid. And, you know, Ben just lets him have it. And if some punk kid did that to one of my kids, I'd ripped him a new hole, too. I'd probably been a lot, you know, not a lot less nice than Ben was, actually.
There's a couple exclamation points in there because it's a Marvel comic, but the demeanor of Ben's body language says he wasn't yelling. Like, I imagine Ben saying all those strongly worded statements in a just very calm, purposeful, you know, pointed way that made Flash feel like that body language. His Flash just feels like he's smaller than nothing, which is great. Ben just totally put him in his place. I love it.
Yeah, his shoulders are all slumped. His head's like almost halfway down to his navel because he's all slumped over, you know. Just like he looks like Archie Andrews just found out Betty and Veronica want nothing to do with him, you know.
Right. I mean,
that's what he looks like. And you're right. I mean, Ben probably came at Flash the way, you know, when I get upset, I get all, and Cindy just gets super calm, and it's much more effective than getting all, you know, so that's probably what he did. Yeah, it's a great little bit. I kind of feel like because the kids, Peter's high school friends, that's really the only scene they're really in. So I kind of wonder if Peter Gillis wasn't just like striking back for all the bullied comic readers. He had a chance.
Could be.
To put Flash Thompson in his place, and he did. So. So what did you think about how Ben learned Peter's secret?
Well, the learning part, you know, where he sees him out the window is fine. But what I really liked was the reveal where he like, rather than just confronting Peter, he puts together this elaborate, you know, thing with the table. He hides the Spider-Man costume under the tablecloth and makes Peter go take off the tablecloth, you know, rather than just coming out and saying it. I love that reveal because it's a great dramatic, you know, flip. And instead of Ben, you know, raging and going, how could you keep this from me? He's just like, we have to talk, Peter. And I think that's a fantastic moment. And I, not knowing my Spider-Man history, I feel like it's something different than we would have ever got with May. So I really like it.
Oh yeah, definitely. You know, and it's, you know, that gets us to the next scene where they talk about, Peter tells him what happened, and he's here, you know, he's obviously crying, and he tells him about, you know, he feels responsible for May's death because he let the burglar go, you know, at his, he ran past him in the hallway when he was coming out of one of his TV appearances. And then Ben, as her husband, feels like he failed her just as much as Peter did, you know, so they get to bond over this in a way that Peter and May never did. Because that was, you know, that was the conceit that she, you know, Aunt May must never know. And, you know, and he would never tell her, and her heart's too weak. She can't take it. Or, you know, she didn't like Spider-Man and, you know, all this and that. But this is so much more. I think it's a more, you know, it's a more mature way to go with the characters. You know, like when Lee was writing it, it was like some characters, like Aunt May was basically a plot device. You know, mm-hmm. I mean, she really was. But, you know, he's like actually fleshing out Ben Parker's character a lot. Here. And in fact, when Ben is so enraged at himself, he looks like Carol O'Connor, you know. So,
yeah, okay, I see that. Yeah,
he looks like Archie Bunker, or, you know, yep. In the Heat of the Night, whichever way you prefer your Carol O'Connor.
So I feel like for me, this was the most powerful moment in the whole issue. Is Ben yelling, and maybe it's just as a husband, I feel it too much. I don't know, but he's just yelling, you know, about himself. He's like, that man shot my May, and I slept through it. I slept through it. And just his own grief. Because, you know, for years, we always focus on Peter's grief, right? And the fact that here's someone else that shares the grief with him. For me, that's the most powerful moment in the book, was right there. And then that leads to this interesting, different world where Peter has an adult confidant through his whole career from this point on. He has someone he can talk to about, you know, as someone who can guide him and give him advice and, you know, sometimes make decisions he's not thrilled about. But either way, he's got a confidant, which is something Peter never had, you know, an adult confidant. So it was really cool.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, exactly. This is a new dynamic. And, you know, this is before Peter, you know, in the modern comics would, you know, become a protege of Tony Stark. And then, of course, in the movies. Yeah. And you know, and of course, in the movies, Aunt May, in the Tom Holland movies, Aunt May does become, you know, his adult confidant, which is, you know, is a nice way to go mm-hmm. with it. But, yeah, this is a first. It definitely is. It's a really nice wrinkle to go with. I think Peter Gillis was probably, I think he wrote quite a few what ifs, but I bet you when he came up with this one, he's like, aha, you know. Then we get to, you know, we get into the montage of Spider-Man fighting a lot of his villains, and Friends really gets to just straight up recreate some classic Ditko images in that montage. And this all leads to Ben confronting Jameson. It not only gives us a great scene, but it also helps explain why Jameson hates Spider-Man so much, because that's often lost over the years. Here he just hates that he's an ex-TV star who he feels is now out for any publicity he can can get, which, you know, I mean, yeah, that's still a little thin. I mean, if the guy's not making any money, at some point you got to say, well, he's risking his life. What's he doing this for? But, you know, but not into Jameson's mind, which in the Lee era, I mean, you know, Jameson funded supervillains basically to get Spider-Man. So, yeah, but I love Jonah's reaction to how Ben is basically bossing Spidey around. What power can this man have? Spider-Man's never spoken like that before. You know, it's just, you know, you can just imagine J.K. Simmons saying these things. Right.
So it was a good impersonation too, by the way.
Oh, thanks. Yeah. And that splash page where Peter is unmasked, his head's hanging low, it's Ben presents him to Jameson. That's really powerful. It shows how Peter is now being pulled between these two older figures. And like, it's years before that god-awful Civil War comic crap. So, you know.
Careful there. I actually, that's what brought me back to Spider-Man was the JMS stuff where Peter was dealing with the Civil War stuff. All of that brought me back, believe it or not.
So, okay. All right.
I also like Electric Blue Superman. So there's no accounting for text. So.
Yeah, I think this could have really backfired on Ben and Peter, of course. But Gillis doubles down on Ben being almost obsessed with responsibility, and it makes sense that he'd want to prove to Jameson that Peter was, you know, on the level. And like I said, I don't know. I'd say somewhere in a flashback they had established that, you know, Ben told Peter, with great power there comes great responsibility. I can't imagine Sam Raimi and the script writers came up with that. Andy Leyland could probably tell us. Andy, if you're listening to this, write us in a comment. Let us know. He would know.
But I feel like Andy actually talked about it on one of his Palace of Glittering Delights, like identified where the phrase came from. I feel like I listened to one of those episodes. Because again, I listen to a lot of his episodes and I have no idea what he's talking about because I haven't seen or read those Spider-Man comics, but it makes a great listen because Andy's awesome. So,
oh, yeah. But, yeah, he does a great job with the Spider-Man coverage. And it is in Amazing Fantasy 15, but I just don't know when they attribute it to Uncle Ben. So,
sure, right.
Yeah. I do like, too, the page of Jameson deciding what to do with the info. It's great. I do have to wonder, though, Spider-Man swings out. You know, Ben comes in, walks past everybody, confronts Jameson, and then Spider-Man's outside listening, then comes in. It's like, Uncle Ben, or, no, please, no. You know, we've got to do this. And has him unmasked, and he's like, it's up to you to decide what to do with this, Jameson. And he swings out with Peter. So what did Betty Brant and all the other people at the Daily Bugle wonder? Where'd that old guy go that just walked into Jonah's office?
Jameson pushed him out the window is what they're thinking. You know, yeah, they wouldn't put it past him at that point.
He Max Shrek'd him out the window, yeah.
Oh, my gosh. So this leads to a really interesting thing that goes on here. So, you know, once the identity's revealed, you know, the Daily Bugle kind of has an arrangement where they follow Spider-Man around because Peter's on their payroll. So they're always there, you know, whenever Spider-Man makes a bust. Now, and Peter even talks about that later on when him and Jameson are talking about Betty. But, like, it feels a little shady to me. Like, I have a hard time accepting that Peter would be okay with Jameson following him around just so he can get more Spider-Man press. I don't know. It's kind of weird.
I don't think if it was Superman doing this, it would bother me. But where it's Spider-Man, I mean, he did make money of selling photographs of himself, you know. And,
yeah, it's true.
And basically lying about the fact that he was just nearby taking pictures when he just webbed his automatic camera up to a wall and took pictures of himself fighting Electro or whatever, you know. So, you know, I get the kind of feeling that the Bugle, Jameson's getting tips about things and, you know, they're working together. Like, you know, I heard about this. Did you hear about this? That kind of thing. Like, did you hear about this bust going down and this, you know, there's going to be a bank robbery or something, you know, and they like feed each other information and Jonah would make sure that there'd be reporters there and other photographers. And, but yeah, it is a little on the shady side, but it's not as shady as funding supervillain.
Yeah. That's fair. That's good. Spider Slayers, if I remember right. Isn't that right? And Scorpion?
Yeah, Spider and Scorpion. The Scorpion. Yeah.
See, I pick up some things.
Yeah. But, you know, I have to say, it's interesting that Gillis hinges the fulcrum of this story on a lesser-known one from the Lee Ditko run, Amazing Spider-Man. I think it's 11 through 12, which was like the first return of Dr. Octopus. But that in that story, Bennett Brant actually gets killed.
Okay.
Spoiler warning. And Betty then never fully forgives Spider-Man, or at least for a very long time, you know. And so that's another person that Peter loves that doesn't like Spider-Man now. So, And the Betty Peter romance in the comic was really sweet. He was like this, you know, older woman that he had a crush on, but she wasn't that much older. So, you know, maybe nowadays it would be like, wait a minute, isn't he only supposed to be 16? How old are you? You know, or something.
Thank you, Mrs. Brandt.
That's right. Yeah.
So how different is the Betty Brandt story then with Mr. Big or whoever it is? I've lost track of the names, but you know, with Doc Ock and all that and Betty's brother. So the story, I guess what my question is, did Uncle Ben make that story turn out different, the Betty Brandt story?
Well, yeah, apparently, because I don't particularly know what, you know, I haven't gone back and reread those issues, and maybe okay. I should have, but basically what happens in that story is that Bennett ends up taking a bullet that could have went to Betty, if I remember right, and dies. And, you know, I don't really know why that would change because Uncle Ben was involved, but maybe Peter's head wasn't quite as in the game. I think Peter kind of already knew in the original story that, you know, oh, wait a minute, how'd she get mixed up with Dr. Octopus? But he was still obviously going to help her. Mm-hmm. And here he's like trying to prove, well, she wouldn't be mixed up with these people. And then he finds out, oh, wait, she is.
Okay.
So maybe because he's, I don't know why it would turn out that way, but you know, it's what if something. Sometimes things change.
Uncle Ben did say, Peter, I think you should investigate it. So maybe that's part of the piece of it. Either way, I didn't mean to dwell on it. Again, this is where I felt like, okay, as I read these scenes, I'm like, okay, I'm clearly missing something here that I'm not getting. I'm following what's happening on the page, but I get the sense that this is another story and it's turning out differently and I don't know why or how and why it's relevant. So that's where I was feeling a little lost. But that's the nature of Who's Who's. I mean, I keep calling them Who's Who's. What ifs?
Yeah, and I think, if I remember right, the events in this did kind of bring Peter and Betty a little closer together because he was concerned about her. And the one thing about this story that I've kind of always been like, I know Peter loved Betty as a first crush, but for him to basically give up everything and go live in alleys in his Spider-Man costume seems a bit much. That's the one part of the story. I'm like, did he just like, and it's a big gap. Like, how long was he in that alley? It's like literally from Spider-Man number 12 to number 42 for 30 issues. He's like stinking and not shaving and living as Spider-Man, you know, or he's at least not, he's slumming around as Spider-Man more, and he's missing class because one of his teachers comes by and tells Ben it's a real shame, but if he doesn't come back to school, he'll flunk and, you know, all this.
Yeah. I just assumed it was like a week or so is what I was thinking. But and I guess some of it, too, is just it's not just the Betty stuff, but also the push and pull between J. Jonah and Uncle Ben. I think it's all that controlling, too, is probably what's causing it. But yeah, if there's a gap of that many issues, yeah, that's a problem.
Yeah. And it might, you know, the timeline might be accelerated differently. You know, different things are happening. You know, John Jameson gets exposed to space spores earlier than he did in the 616 universe. So but yeah, it's definitely. The way he feels like, you know, he doesn't get to make any decisions anymore. Ben and Jameson are, you know, ruling his life, and they were right. And, you know, rather than just say, well, they were right, he's like mad about it, you know. But like, as Andy Leyland has pointed out in his coverage of the Spider-Man stories throughout the decades, Peter is a bit of a hothead, you know, so he's a bit impetuous sometimes, you know. He's not perfect by any means, so you can kind of understand why they're fine, I'll just go off and live in the alleyway Spider-Man, you know. So. they don't get into it here, but the Stooley Patch, who holds up the banner where Jonah is going to expose Spider-Man, it's supposed to be the headline, you know, Spider-Man's identity revealed. That was an identity of Bugle reporter Frederick Foswell, who had previously been the big man that we saw in a flashback panel. So,
oh, geez.
Yeah, it's all tangled. This is what a tangled web we weave.
Oh, gosh, you've earned your nerd card. Don't worry.
And the ending may seem a bit wild and rushed, but Gillis is again working that story of Amazing Spider-Man number 42, where John Jameson grows to giant size with superpowers via space spore exposure. Later, he gets on the moon and wears his appendant, will turn him into a werewolf. Stay out of space, John Jameson. Just retire. You know, go talk at schools. You know, don't go back into space. You know, it's just not going to work out for you.
I think in the cartoon, didn't he bring the Venom symbiote back to Earth with him also or something?
Yes, in the 90s cartoon, yeah. Which I always wondered why Amazing Spider-Man 3 didn't do that since they'd already introduced John Jameson. You know,
right,
I never understood why they didn't. That was a much better way than, oh, it just fell out of space in a little rock. Mm-hmm. Yeah, just... Mm-hmm. it is kind of interesting that Friends starts drawing Peter a bit more Romita-like here in the scenes that in the era that Romita's drawing. He's a little more handsome, a little more filled out. So he's a little he's channeling Romita now. So yeah, and I did note one thing at the end. The final bugle, of course, has a big headline that, you know, astronaut hero saves father or whatever. But it shows that Norman Osborn was exposed as the Green Goblin. So maybe if Peter has met Gwen, he can really have a happy ending.
Oh, okay. Well, I mean, you know, Green Goblin can always escape from jail.
He could. But, yeah. He could. But he was never exposed as the Green Goblin before.
True.
His identity was still a secret. So maybe things turn out pretty good, because I think either way, though, Peter's life, I think it's going to be a lot better with Ben in it as his, you know, almost like Ma and Pa Kent in the post-crisis era. Ooh,
yeah, good analogy.
Yeah, so, you know, how much better was Superman's life? You know, he had a home to go to. He had confidants and people to lean on that he could talk to. He could go home and be Clark Kent, you know, farm boy. So, you know, Peter can go home and be Peter Parker, not Spider-Man, not the nerd people pick on, you know. So I like the idea. I would like to have seen him do more with this, but, you know, it's kind of perfect the way it is. Why mess with it? So
it was very enjoyable. I really enjoyed it. Again, this is my first time reading it, and folks, you can read it on Marvel Unlimited. It's out there. It was a fun story. Again, other than just feeling a little adrift with a couple of plot points, but still got through it, just adrift as far as the how they came out in the real world. I thought it was great, and like you said, the art is gorgeous the whole way through it. It's super fun. What a great, and has you know, an upbeat ending, which not many What Ifs have that, by the way. I've done some research recently, so
yeah, there's some of them are pretty downright, oh my god, you know, just when you
I'll just tell you guys up front, like when Chris and I started talking about doing this, I picked a completely different issue I was going to cover, okay? And it's a pretty good one, actually, but it had a downbeat ending. And so I was watching What If Season 2, and I watched Episode 2, which is What If Peter Quill Attacked Earth's Mightiest Heroes? And damn, that episode is amazing. It's mm-hmm. so good. It's so inspirational. It's so upbeat that I'm like, I watched that. I'm like, literally just at that moment, I have to change comics. I have to find a different comic to cover because I want to be upbeat. It took a long time to find a What If comic that doesn't have a super dark ending or just have super, super dark content that's just too much. Because, I mean, they go really dark, man. I mean, really dark. Yeah. Well, that was a great one, Chris. Thank you so much for bringing that. That was super fun. And as Chris brought us an issue that echoed some awesome 1960s art, boy, have I brought the 90s, folks. Let me tell you. I am covering What If Volume 2, Number 66, What If Rogue Possessed the Power of Thor? Now, this is published by Marvel Comics, cover date October 1994, on the shelves August 16th, 1994. Aw, 1994 Marvel, so you know it's got to be good, right, folks? Cover price is $1.50, page count's 28 pages, and the cover's by John Royals and Bambos. He, at some point in his career, he just started going by his last name, so that's what we're going to use. So on the cover, you've got, obviously, your What If trade dress and all that business, and it has got a extremely 90s version of Rogue in a, you know, a blue bodice kind of costume, and it's, you know, she's got all kinds of double belts and straps and all that, and she's holding aloft Thor's hammer. She's got a spike collar and a tattered cape and all this, and energy's crackling off her, and at her feet are the perhaps unconscious, perhaps dead, defeated, we don't know, Iron Man, Beast, Vision, Scarlet Witch, then you've got Mystique and Pyro and the Blob as well. So what if Rogue possessed the power of Thor? What do you think of this cover, buddy?
It is very 90s.
Yes, it is.
It's very image-like, but I think it does sell the concept. You know, I will give it that. It's you can look at this and go, oh, okay. You know, what if Rogue possessed the power of Thor? She's got Mjolnir. You know, she looks a little Thor-esque. You know, there are things that are distracting, like Wanda's super shiny bustier. I don't know why it's that shiny, but okay. But it works. You know, it's there might be a reason Marvel went bankrupt in this era. I'm just saying, but you know.
Well, they were desperately chasing Image at this point. I mean, you know, yeah. all their hot stars left them and go formed Image, you know, for reasons. And so Marvel's chasing it because they're quickly feeling, you know, left out. And look, I'll just put up on Front Street, I really enjoy the story here. And I enjoy some of the art because I do like 90s stuff. But yeah, as Chris said, distracting things. I mean, all the women's clothes in this comic, I'll just put it right. All of their women's clothes are like vacuum sealed to their bodies, specifically to their breasts. It's ridiculous. Okay. There it's said, we don't need to dwell on it. It's nuts, folks, but it's still a fun read, I think. So
I did too. Yeah.
Awesome. Well, I'm glad you enjoyed it. So let's get into this, folks. So the writer is Simon Furman. Penciler is John Royal. Inker is Bambos. Letter is Janice Chang. Colorist is Tom Smith. Editor is Rob Tokar. And editor-in-chief is Tom DeFalco. Now, interestingly enough, in this issue, rather than Uatu, the Watcher, providing the framing sequence, is provided by a member of the Brotherhood of Evil Mutants, specifically Destiny. So in Marvel history terms, this story takes place, it starts off at least, in the middle of Avengers Annual number 10, which is Rogue's first appearance. So the issue itself opens with Destiny foreseeing a possible future, which then the reader gets to read in the form of this whole comic book. So in the story, Rogue is battling the Avengers, and she's preparing to free the Brotherhood of Evil Mutants from jail. Rogue absorbs some of Thor's powers and revels in how powerful she's become. Now, this is the inflection point for the historical turning point. You know, Rogue has to choose whether to absorb more of Thor's power or use him as a human shield. In Avengers Annual, she uses him as a human shield. Here, however, in this reality, she chooses to become even more powerful and drains more of Thor's power. But something goes wrong with the transfer, and she drains him completely, leaving Thor in a vegetated state. Rogue now uses her new Thor powers to devastate the Avengers, which leaves Vision and Jocasta dead. Rogue somehow then wields Thor's magic hammer, which leaves everyone confused, and she flies away, off to help the Brotherhood of Evil Mutants escape from prison. The remaining Avengers take Thor's body to the Fantastic Four to see if they can help him, but Thor is declared dead. According to Reed Richards, however impossible as it sounds, Rogue is now Thor. Now, over in Asgard, Odin is grief-stricken to find out that his son has died, but he can't, for whatever reason, revoke Thor's powers from Rogue. So Odin orders Baldur and the Warriors Three to investigate and to take out Rogue if necessary. In the meantime, the Brotherhood of Evil Mutants have escaped jail and are flying away in their jet airplane, and the Blob, being skeevy, tries to make a pass at the new Rogue, which leads to a conflict, and then Pyro fires a blast that brings down the entire jet. Everyone is killed except for Rogue, and she feels terrible. You know, she feels so responsible and distraught, especially that she got Mystique killed, you know, the woman who was like a mother to her. Then, unexpectedly, Loki appears and offers to help fulfill Rogue's true destiny among the gods if she comes with him. Much later, we're with Rogue while she's dreaming, and she's in a drift in these memories of heroism and Thor. She awakens in a remote region of Asgard, confused and really unsure of her own memories. You know, Loki's been telling her all these lies, calling her sister and suggesting that she is Thor and simply transformed. He convinces her that the other Asgardians are jealous of her power and Loki's, and that she was exiled to Earth by these other Asgardians. Loki tells her that they're going to rise up and reclaim Rogue's place, really Thor's place, and together Loki and Rogue will rule Asgard. As Loki's forces invade Asgard, Loki tells Rogue to kill Odin. Unable to kill a father so full of love, Rogue suddenly finds herself on the astral plane, face to face with the spirit of the real Thor. The God of Thunder encourages Rogue to accept his old mantle. She realizes that the Goddess of Thor is her identity, and she must hold herself to those standards. She defeats Loki and helps the other heroes in wiping out Loki's forces. She accepts her new role as the new Thor, and Odin accepts her as his daughter. In the end, we return to the framing sequence for this issue with Destiny and the Brotherhood of Evil Mutants, and Destiny sees that possible future has now passed, it's not to be, and things have returned to the normal course of history. Though Destiny mourns that in this timeline, Rogue will never find the happiness and purpose that she did as Thor. All right, so there we go. What'd you think of this one, buddy?
Well, clearly she knew that she was going to end up marrying Gambit, and he's no good, so that's why she did that.
That could be true. Yes, yes.
Yeah, this was fun in a bat crap, balls to the walls kind of way. I mean, it was just, wow. And it does end in a positive note, but there's a pretty high body count in this one, I will say.
Well, it's interesting. The body count isn't as high as they advertise. Like, there's a bit in there where, you know, we see Vision die, we see Jocasta die, but, you know, come on, they're robots. It's not that bad, right? But they also say that Hawkeye's dead. However, they say that in this one page before, Hawkeye's in the panel. The artist drew Hawkeye alive and well with them in the same scene where they're saying Hawkeye's dead. So it's an artistic mistake or a writing mistake. I don't know which one came first. But so as far as I'm concerned, Hawkeye survives. So really, all we really lost were the robots. That's my take on it.
It's a Super Friends type thing is what it is. It's like, yes. You know, like, so we've talked about that before. Batman's supposed to be dead, but he's standing there with the rest of them. So
yes, exactly right. And you know, okay, the Brother of Evil Mutants died. Are we really going to shed a tear over that? No, not really.
No, because the Blob, Skeevy, and Pyro is a freaking moron for using his powers on a jet-fueled plane.
I mean, right. But it does seem like, I mean, it seems completely plausible that that would happen in an X-Men comic book, though. It really feels that way.
Oh, yeah. They're all idiots. So, yeah, it's in their obviously hotheads. So, yeah, it totally makes sense. So, yeah. I had you ever ran into John Royal before, his artwork?
No, I did some super fast Googling, right? You say you're big because you had more on him than I did before what I found, but go ahead.
I guess he and Furman came from Marvel UK because it looks like, you know, he did a lot of the Marvel UK comics that they distributed over here in the early 90s. I know Simon Furman came from there because he was huge with Transformers fans. He ended up writing the US Transformers book toward the end, and he co-created Death's Head, who was, you know, big there for a while. And so, yeah, I think they must have both came from the Marvel UK office and then started getting, well, I don't know at this point that maybe the UK office had shut down. I know it was big there for a little bit, and then it seemed like they kind of, just like every comic publisher, they overdid it, and then it like immediately kind of imploded. So
I think you and I have an overinflated sense of Marvel UK for the same reason. We were both working at comic shops at the time. Mm. And I think for most other people, they kind of go like, Marvel UK, that was a thing? Yeah. Whereas you and I remember all of these things, right? Because I mean, they were on the shelves and it was exciting. And Liam Sharp, I think was his name, came from there too. And a lot of really great stuff. But yeah, so some quick Googling for Royal, you know, came up with Knights of Pendragon. Absolutely a Marvel UK title. Looks like he also worked on Doom 2099 a little bit, some Wolverine stuff. And nowadays he's overdoing stuff for Zenoscope. And if you know what Zenoscope is and you know that he likes to draw beautiful women here in this issue, there's your answer. But
yes. More than shiny bustiers.
Right. A lot more than that. But bustier is an operative word there.
Yes.
Now, you know, Rogue in here, I do like that he gets Rogue three different costumes throughout the comic. Like, she has her original, like, from Avengers Annual, right? But then very quickly gets that 90s, like, it's a ridiculous 90s costume, right? It's all tattered, and, you know, capes and torn, and the spike collar and wristbands, but it's, like, so 90s, right? But then at the end, she gets kind of a cool, you know, still very 90s, feminine version of Thor's costume. So I like that they gave some differentiation there.
Yeah, it was a nice touch. You know, and I like the fact that, you know, he had her looking like the Rogue at the time, and I kind of did miss these events took place in, you know, Avengers Annual number 10 or whatever, like you said, but I kind of knew that because I knew Rogue first appeared in an Avengers Annual, so I'm like, oh, this must be where this is coming from, so I didn't have to look it up, but it would have been nice to have a little editor's note. So,
well, it's the same thing I was kind of, you know, fussing about with the Spider-Man one. It's like, you know, if you're kind of adrift, you don't know where the inflection point is, you don't know what has specific, you know, there's history's changed, but you don't necessarily know what. Now they do have a footnote at the very first page. It just says some years ago, circa Avengers Annual number 10 to be exact. But they don't tell you.
That.
Yeah, but they don't tell you anything else. Okay. They don't tell you that the inflection point is she has to choose whether to make Thor a human shield or absorb more power. And that's what, because I went back and checked Avengers Annual, and that is what she did instead. She used him as a human shield. Here she decides to drain him instead. So, gotcha. Yeah, that's not there. Now, there is something here, and I'm probably reading more into it than I could. You know, it's very strange to me that a Watu wasn't in the issue. Now, I know they did that occasionally with the later issues, but it's just strange not having that. But it's an interesting idea to use Destiny for the framing sequence. And there is one point where she has an outburst, and her she just yells in pain, but it's the letter U twice, like U, then U. And I thought, could that be like a super subtle reference to a Watu that has two U's in his name? Or am I like, I'm probably just looking too deep. I don't know.
Maybe. Who knows? I haven't read enough of this. I read more of the early era. era of this run. So maybe they did something with that. I don't know. Maybe she played the Watcher in other issues too. I don't know. So.
Well, it makes sense here, given her role in Avengers Annual. But yes. And I don't think she is used later on. Like, I've read some of these. Like, this one, I read this for this episode. I didn't have this one on stock. I was doing a ton of research, and I found some websites, like TV Tropes, that listed what-ifs that had a happy ending. And that list is very small. And this is one of the ones that listed a happy ending. So I went ahead and tried it. I read a whole bunch of issues going trying to find one, and this one kind of stuck out at me. So that's why I picked it. But so I don't have an extensive knowledge of the later issues, but they were trying different stuff. They even had some crossovers where they do like a 5-issue story across different what if universes. So maybe that's a predecessor to Exiles. I don't know.
Yeah, also a predecessor to what they did in the animated series. So
oh yeah, good point.
Yeah.
So one of the fun things I like is after she absorbs all of Thor's power, her dialogue actually changes to like this interesting mix of Thor speak and her ridiculous Southern drawl. Like she has this one line, "Dost thou not realize what I am now? What I can do?" And it's like, it's corny, but I love that, you know, you and I are both in the South. I love the Southern accent with the crazy, you know, Norse BS way Thor talks. I think it's fun.
Imagine Shakespeare in the trailer park. You know, kind of.
Redneck Avengers.
Oh God, I love that. That's so right.
I watched it again the other night. I love it so much.
He spit on my knife. Yeah, it's like, don't tell him why I bought a coffin. Yeah, that's Danny loves that. That's like one of her favorite things is Redneck Avengers. So
if you don't know what we're talking about, Google was it bad lip sync or something like that? Yeah.
Yeah.
Redneck Avengers. Oh, you'll just die laughing. Anyway. Well, you've got some notes, further notes on the art. Why don't you, because I want to bounce off those. Why don't you mention this?
Well, one thing I noticed is this, you know, John Royall is, he's very imagey. He's very Rob Liefeld-y in particular, I feel like. So, you know, it's kind of more the Image style that hasn't quite aged as well for a lot of people. But I did notice here and there seems to be a little bit of John Byrne, like especially in his female faces. You know, Rogue, Scarlet Witch in particular looks very much like Byrne's Scarlet Witch from West Coast Avengers inside, not so much on the cover. So I noticed that. And, you know, overall, the style aside, there's a few little bad drawings. I think, like, you know, when Rogue catches Mjolnir on page 22, it doesn't really look like it could fit in her hand, like she's holding the handle. There's little things like that, but the storytelling's actually good. You know, it's okay. I can follow it, which is better than a lot of Image-like comics or even Image comics of the time. So, you know, I think he's got some, you know, and I'm sure the guys, you know, went on to have a great career, but Herb Trimpe was made to draw in this style at this time. So, you know, I'm not going to hold this against the guy. I think given the style, whoever decided to draw this way, have this book draw this way, I think for the most part, he did a pretty good job with it. And I do like the fact that he does bring in, you know, a little more polished traditional artist influences like Byrne in places. Sue Storm looks like a John Byrne Sue Storm in particular.
Yeah. I can see that. I also see some Alan Davis in some of the Rogue faces, especially early on, like where she absorbs all of Thor's power and she's just kind of like one eye is kind of squinting, the other eye is big. Like to me, I look at that, I'm like, that looks like absolutely like an Alan Davis face on page. We don't really have page numbers on these things. It's the fifth page in the file we're looking at. It's probably the fourth comic book page, but I see it. Yeah, I think he was probably influenced by a lot of other artists. And I'll take a little bit different position. I really like the art in here. Now, again, you have to understand the time period. You know, 1994, and you're talking about Image artists. Those guys at least could really draw. Most artists teaching and drawing for Marvel in 1994 were terrible. I mean, there's a bunch of terrible comics from Marvel in the mid-90s. And I'm sorry to anyone that, you know, was ever involved with Marvel that I'm saying that, but there were some really bad stuff. And this, you mentioned the storytelling. Like, I'm never confused about what's going on. He's got a lot of really dynamic panel design, a lot of exciting stuff. And I'm partial to the 90s stuff, so that maybe that's, you know, I'm programmed to like crazy, dynamic, over-the-top, extreme everything. But I found this easy to read, fun to read. The expressions were all there. The women, as exaggerated and insane they were sexy. The men, as exaggerated and crazy they were sexy too. You know, I found the art to be a lot of fun and made me very happy and to feel like I was reading a 90s comic I hadn't read before that was a joy.
No, that's good. I mean, that's, you know, and I mean, that's the thing. And obviously you read comics before the 90s, but that was like, you were like working at a comic book shop. You were like really deep into comics at that time. So that's like, you know, a period of your comic reading that's, you know, brings back fond memories. And there's a lot of probably our listeners on the network who came up reading 90s comics. You know, they didn't have 80s comics. They were, you know, they were kids, teens in the 90s, even in their 20s when they first read comics. So yeah, we can kind of crap on them sometimes, but you know, in the long grand scheme of things, it's just the phase comics went through in a style that was popular at the time. And so you just, I don't harsh on it like I used to, because it's just part of the era now. You know, it's, and that's why I said, you know, it's not bad. You know, overall, it's not bad. It's and it's competent storytelling. So, and it's very dynamic. It's very energetic. It's a, that's what, one reason it's balls to the wall. It matches the story. It's just, it's a kinetic, just like, it never slows down. Other than when she's laying in bed and Loki's basically, it kind of was creeping me out a little bit. It's like, is he going to hit on her? She's kind of his sister, his brother, you know. It's like, you know, it's like incest. I don't know, you know, but of course Loki and Thor, I guess, aren't really related, are they? But well, but anyway, they were raised that way.
You could wonder if they slept together. I mean, they don't hint at it, but there's enough of her in the bed and him being very friendly where you could go, did something happen in between pages there?
Yeah, you could, yeah.
It wouldn't put it past Loki, but
no.
Now, by the way, folks, we don't do image galleries on Once Upon a Geek. However, I will post some of these pages on social media, so, you know, like Twitter and Blue Sky, and I'll put a link in the show notes so you can go out there and check out some of these pages and see what we're talking about. And there'll be some from the Spider-Man one issue we cover as well. Now, a question for you. This is kind of the big question that they ask in the issue itself, and we should ask of ourselves. Rogue being able to pick up Mjolnir. Feelings on that?
I don't buy it. I don't buy it before she accepted, her and Thor basically talked, and, you know, he encouraged her to basically accept her heritage, that she's now, you know, he's now part of her and she's part of him and all this, and, you know, they're kind of one being now. Now then I get it. But I mean, when she was a power hungry, you know, psycho sucking his life force out of him, I don't think that's how Mjolnir's supposed to work, based on everything I've ever seen. I mean, I remember the reason I lost my mind in Avengers Endgame when Cap, you know, got Mjolnir was because I read that Thor comic drawn by Ron Frenz, oddly enough, where Cap wields Mjolnir. He's the captain at that point, but Steve Rogers, you know, first uses Mjolnir, but he uses it in battle, and then at the end of the battle, he can't lift it anymore. That's the way it worked in the comics. Okay. So it's really hard to lift Mjolnir if you're not Thor and not worthy, you know? So, so I kind of don't, I mean, I know they kind of say, even Odin's like, I don't know why, you know, she's able to do this. I don't get it. So, you know, they address it, but they don't answer it. So I can accept it for a what if, but like if this was like canon or something, I'd be like, well, wait a minute. That's, you know, it's just.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. If it was 616 and a supervillain picked up Mjolnir, everyone would have lost their mind. You're right. Absolutely. Right. So in this, yeah, I guess you got the argument you got to make, a chicken and the egg kind of thing. Is it her own innate goodness that we eventually saw come out across years of X-Men comics, you know, that Mjolnir sensing? Is it like, okay, you know, she's kind of crappy today, but she's in her heart, she's a good person. Or, and even then, you got to question, is Rogue really qualified to lift her, lift Mjolnir? Or is it that the slice of Thor that she had inside of her at that point is what allowed her to, I mean, I guess that's probably what it has to be, is the slice of Thor that's inside of her is what Mjolnir responded to, going, okay, you know, this is where Thor resides now, is in her body, and so that's okay.
Yeah, I guess so. I guess you'll have to say it that, or, you know, like you said, or Mjolnir is looking ahead to the, you know, Jim Lee jacketed X-Men 90s era Rogue, you know, so.
Right.
It's the animated, you know, X-Men anime, or Anna Paquin. You know, Anna Paquin, I could see, you know, she could lift Mjolnir at any point.
Sure, of course. Yeah, especially during True Blood. Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. There you go.
Now, I started to think about, like, first of all, I do like the fact that at the end, they make a big deal about the message on the hammer changes. It always says, whoever holds the hammer, if he be worthy, shall possess the power of Thor. And now it says, if he or she be worthy. I think that's kind of a nice, cool thing to have that happen there. And then the more I started thinking about it, you know, like, There's a great speech where the spirit of Thor is telling her to accept, you know, the mantle of Thor there, right? And he's saying she's been living this series of stolen thoughts and lives, and her soul was always was a void seeking completeness, which I thought was a really nice message. I was like, oh, this is kind of cool and deep. I like this. Yeah. And she's living for everyone's life but her own. And then he encourages her to accept the mantle because it's a mantle, not just an ideal. And at that part, I kind of scratched my head. I'm like, Thor's a mantle? But then I remembered. Yeah. I mean, Thunderstrike, you know, Eric Masterson took on the role of Thor. Beta Ray Bill kind of sort of took on, the role of Thor there as well. So there is a precedent, even in 1994, for passing on the mantle of Thor. So it worked very, again, even though you're right. Like, if this was not a what if, there's a whole lot of head scratching going, wait a minute. But the fact that it's a what if, it allows you to go, okay, yeah, I can roll with this. And I think it makes for an interesting story that never in a million years would I have wondered about Rogue and the role of Thor.
Yeah, yeah. And I think, you know, one thing about it is Odin seems pretty chill about the whole thing, too, because, you know, Odin, obviously, I mean, he used to get bent out of shape because, you know, Thor wanted to date Jane Foster, you know, I mean, it's like, so I just can't see him, like, you know, being this chill. But, you know, Odin's obviously got, like, you know, some days he's pretty benign and other days he's like, you know, oh, let's just get Ragnarok over with, you know, so, you know, who knows with Odin? She caught him on a sappy day, you know. He's like, man, I really miss my kid. Oh, you're pretty close. Okay. You know,
To be fair, early on, he was raging pretty mad. He was pretty pissed, you know, and then Sif had to chill him out, you know. And I think it's one of those, it's like Thor can either be lost to me or I can accept this woman. You know, maybe he could sense that his son had passed on. I don't know, whatever. I'm no prizing all this, but it worked for me. That's fine.
Yeah, it works. It works within, you know, there's a certain amount of, you know, that's one thing about any kind of these parallel world stories. It's like if characters are a little slightly, you know, if you can say, well, would they really react that way? As long as it's not like, well, I mean, it can be incredibly the other way. That's part of it. But it's like, you know, that's kind of written into it that they can, they're a little more pliable, you know, in these alternate realities.
So. Yeah. Now, folks, this issue is not available on Marvel Unlimited. So you got to find it in the back issue bins or online somewhere, whatever you want to do. Again, I'll throw a couple pages up on social media for you to check out. I find it to be a lot of fun. It was an unexpected one for me because, again, I hadn't read this one before. I was just following up some, you know, research on trying to find a happy ending on in a what if. So, again, I want to hear in the comments section some of your favorite what ifs because we're going to keep doing these episodes. They're a lot of fun. I'm not going to guarantee how often. I mean, it's been a year since we did the last one, but I do enjoy doing these and I love talking about it. And I'm always looking for great suggestions for other what ifs and throw it in the comments there. Well, thank you so much for doing this, Chris, for appearing on this Once Upon a Geek to talk about and share your love of What If. It's been a blast. Why don't you tell the listeners where they can find more of you?
Well, you can hear me right here on the Fire and Water Podcast Network, where I co-host JLUcast with my wife, Cindy. We cover the Justice League Unlimited animated series, and we're now into season 3. So we're in the home stretch. It's the final season. So then I got to figure out what I'm going to do with my life after that. So...
Hey, I've been there, buddy. You know, I'm wrapping up Justice League in about 8 months, so I totally understand. It's a kind of an exciting thing to not know what's next. It's fun.
Yeah, it is. It is. Yeah, it's like somebody's going to have to start a Justice League series on the network because we're not going to have any. You know.
Well, you know, between the Super Friends series ending and Justice League International ending and JLU ending, you're right. We had three going, but yeah. I am picking up the mantle and running the Justice Society podcast. So that'll be a monthly show on the network. So it's got justice out there. It's just it's not a league. It's a society. It's a little more civilized, I like to think.
And we're tying into our parallel worlds thing, at least the way they used to be, the JSA. So, nice synergy there.
I'm covering post-crisis, Chris. Don't try and make this about you.
I know what you're covering, and I'm really looking forward to it because I love that series. Oh, and I'm already booked for an issue, so I'm really excited.
Oh,
so.
Folks, it's going to be great. And then, you know, we do the Parabek series, we do the mini series, and then we're doing the Jeff Johns stuff. Oh, it's going to be so much fun. Mm-hmm. Well, again, thank you so much, Chris. I really, really appreciate you being here.
Oh, well, thanks for having me. It was a lot of fun. I enjoyed talking about both comics, and yes, I enjoyed that 90s issue. That was fun.
That makes me so happy to hear that Chris enjoyed a 90s comic. That just brings me joy. And folks, come back next time when we're going to find another topic that brings us joy. And what will that topic be? Sorry, everyone. You're just going to have to wait and find out next episode. Thanks for listening, everyone. Until next time, I'm Shag.
And I'm Chris.
And remember, life is short. Focus on the positive.
Find your joy.